It's the Famous Monsters Podcast, the official podcast of Famous Monsters of Filmland Magazine.
Welcome to the Famous Monsters Podcast, the official podcast of Forrest J. Ackerman's classic magazine that started it all back in 1958. Often imitated, never duplicated, we're more than just monsters. We cover sci-fi, fantasy, horror, and all kinds of genre pop culture, living up to Forrest's classic roots while staying current and ahead of the curve.
Just tell me one thing, Burke. You're going out there to destroy them, right? Not to study, not to bring back, but to wipe them out.
That's the plan.
I'm David Weiner, editor of Famous Monsters magazine, and that was a clip from Aliens, one of cinema's most influential sci-fi action adventures, and one of the all-time great sequels that arguably outshines the original. July marks the 30-year anniversary of Aliens' release in theaters, and for the occasion, I spoke with writer-director James Cameron for issue number 286 of Famous Monsters magazine. Of course, Cameron is neck deep in not one but four sequels to his blockbuster hit Avatar, so when I reached out to him, I expected pretty much absolute silence. But to my very pleasant surprise, he confirmed his status as a longtime fan of Famous Monsters and gladly gave me 45 minutes of his time to talk exclusively about Aliens, his early days working with Roger Corman, his monster movie inspirations, and he even provided some insight into his Avatar sequels, which he told me that he is filming concurrently rather than back-to-back. For the full James Cameron interview, you'll have to pick up a copy of the new Famous Monsters. But for today's podcast, I decided to offer up some very healthy portions of our chat, starting with the origins of his idea for Aliens and his efforts to move away from Ridley Scott's original film, while remaining stylistically true to the source material.
I felt that it was important to be stylistically continuous with the first film, but in terms of the way the story is told, the elements of the story, introducing a more militaristic, not militaristic approach, but the idea of a future military, that was just a way into it that made it different, that was a distinguishing factor. And, you know, I mean, it was in my mind, it was a kind of a response to Vietnam, where you had the high-tech, highly funded military, U.S. military, going in and fighting a guerrilla war against guys that were barefoot in the jungle and losing. And with all the helicopters and all the machine guns and the bombs, they lost. You know, or they were consistently losing out in the bush, and I thought it really became a movie about hubris, about people going in with an expectation and an unexpected enemy that is more powerful than you, and you know that was just a fun premise. So you know, I had to carve out territory and make it my own, and I had been doing a lot of design work and thinking in terms of suits and weapons and things like that. So it was easy to graft on a lot of things that I had developed for my own, for other projects that I was writing that were originals. When the opportunity to write a sequel to Alien came along, I thought, oh, I'll just use this stuff. You know, I had a story that I was developing called Mother, that was about a mother extraterrestrial, you know, monster basically that would do anything to defend its young, its offspring. And I thought, well, what is Alien all about? It's about eggs. Well, who laid the eggs? You know, where'd all those damn eggs come from? Don't we want to meet her? And so it was actually a fairly simple progression of ideas, and it all happened very fast. I got the gig to write what we called Alien 2 at the time, I think in October, and within 3 months I had written my shooting draft of Terminator, I'd written the first and second draft of Rambo First Blood Part 2, and I wrote the treatment and the first half of the script for what became Aliens, all in a three-month period. So
wow.
It happened very fast. And the producers on it, you know, Walter Hill and David Giler and Gordon Carroll, who had produced the first film, they were furious with me when I said, I've got to go direct The Terminator. I can't finish this script. And you know, David Giler yelled and screamed at me on the phone and said, "You'll never work in this town again." He literally, those words actually came out of his mouth. It was so damn funny in retrospect. At the time, I was mortified. And then Walter Hill was much calmer about it. He said, "Look, you got a directing gig. You got to go do it. Just send me the pages. Send me what you've got." So I sent them the first 60 pages. And there was this long pause, and I was basically shitting myself. And then Walter Hill called me back the next day and said, "We'll wait.
This time, oh, wow.
We're going to wait for you." And I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah, kid, just don't screw this up." that was always Walter's advice on everything. Just don't screw it up. Yeah, so he didn't actually say screw it up. He said, you know, he said something a little rougher.
Yeah.
But anyway, so... So I went off and did Terminator, and then I came back, and I dutifully went straight back into Alien 2. And at this point now, I was kind of like starting to become the new hot thing, you know. And mm-hmm. some of my newfound friends, you know, agents and other producers and things said, "Oh, no, you don't want to do a sequel to this Ridley Scott film." I said, it's a no-win scenario. Anything you do that's good is going to be considered Ridley's, and anything you do that's bad is going to be you.
Mm.
And I thought, yeah, you're right. Wow, I never thought of it that way. But here's the problem. I really like it, and I'm going to do it. So shut up.
Because did you feel obligated to contact Ridley at some point during the process to pass the baton?
No, that I did not want to do. I had to make it my own. There was no upside to contacting Ridley. I wanted to honor him, and I didn't need to know anything about him. I didn't need to know what kind of shoes he wore or where he lived or what his thinking was. The movie was there for everybody to see. So I thought, all right, my brief is to take what has inspired us all in the science fiction horror community, take from this film what is great about it and honor that and yet still tell my own story.
Sure.
And I didn't see how talking to Ridley would help me make it my story, you know, because I knew in my heart I was going to honor that film. I wouldn't have been doing it if I didn't think it was great. You know, unfortunately,
right.
Some filmmakers came along afterwards who didn't feel it was necessary to honor what had gone before them. That
mm-hmm.
their highest priority was to make it theirs. And frankly, I think they botched it up. Not mentioning any names, but we know who they are.
Sure.
But, you know, my goals were twofold, and one was not prioritized over the other. The first goal was to honor and continue what Ridley had started, and the second goal was to make it my own film.
Arguably, the greatest element to come out of Ridley Scott's Alien was the design of the title character itself, the Xenomorph. And I always wondered why H.R. Giger was not brought on to work on Aliens, whether for new designs or simply in an advisory capacity. The Candid Cameron explains why, and then we move on to how he approached the production of Aliens, coming from the Corman School of Indie Filmmaking.
The one thing that I've been criticized on is not bringing Giger back.
Correct. Yeah.
And even I heard through his people that he was kind of disappointed and a bit had his nose out of joint about that. But I felt that was in the same, it was in the same realm as you know, talking to Ridley and taking dictation from him. It wouldn't have been my film at that point. And frankly, you know, the thing that interested me was taking those designs, taking those motifs and creating new designs from them. So I think the Alien Queen, while it's relatively consistent with Giger, is its own creation. But it feels like it's from the same kind of biology, you know. It's
absolutely, yeah, very much cut from the same cloth.
Yeah, exactly. And I designed the Alien Queen, so that was one of the things I wanted to do. I had such a clear picture of that creature in my head. It was like, well, why do I want to have to, you know, try to have someone else interpret what I'm already seeing? It doesn't, and you know, you call that ego, whatever it is. I think anybody who creates anything has an ego. It's just a question of how they apply it, and
sure.
whether they can do it in a way that doesn't step on toes. Now, I fell all over myself to apologize to Giger after the fact.
I've actually read that letter. That red letter has made the rounds out in the ether, and it's a very eloquent letter that's very respectful. And
I was a huge fan. A huge fan. But there's being a pure fan, and then there's being a fan who also has an aspiration to play in the same space, where you're a fan because you're inspired by something somebody has done. And at that point, you have to make a healthy transition to your own creation, you know. And, when I see people emulating things I've done in film, I applaud them. It's like, yeah, sure, run with these ideas. I was standing on the shoulders of other people when I did my stuff. Why wouldn't, you know, to me it's a metric of having accomplished something and put it out into the zeitgeist and having it be picked up as a baton by other artists, and then they run with it. It's like, I don't feel upset by that, you know.
Going back to Corman, he's all about budget and resourcefulness. And So you're leaping from that sort of school of filmmaking to Terminator and then right into Aliens. What did use in terms of your knowledge from that past? How did you apply that to the production of Aliens?
Aliens was made for, at the time, I think it was a $16 million. It was budgeted at 14. We slipped a little bit. But you know, we basically applied, and by we, I mean myself and Gail Ann Hurd, who was my producing partner and also at the time my wife. And we went to England, where we believed that we could get large, elaborate sets built cheaper than they could be done on sound stages in the U.S. at that time, and that was true. At that point in your life as a filmmaker, you're a gypsy and you go where it is the cheapest to shoot and to build. And that's what we did. And we tried to apply the lessons of the kind of guerrilla style, Corman style filmmaking that we had done in the past. It just didn't work in England. We had to modify a lot because England was much more stultified and union oriented. Even though they were cheaper in terms of the craftsmanship, the set construction and so on, they were definitely 9-to-5 crews. And we were used to 9-to-whatever, 9 right. Until the sun came up and stopped you, you know, if it was a night shoot.
Sure.
So, there was a big culture clash on that film, but we still managed to extract a pretty strong-looking film for using relatively cheap techniques. We used everything, all the tricks that we had worked out at doing visual effects on Corman films. Myself working with the Skotak brothers, with Robert and Dennis Skotak, down at Corman's facility in Venice, which was called the Lumber Company because it used to be a lumber company. And things like foreground hanging miniatures, which is a real lost art now, matte paintings that are done on glass, models hanging on wires, the old Lydecker style of sort of puppeteering large aerial models, you know, like the crash of the dropship and things like that. We used a lot of rear projection and front projection, a lot of tricks, that save you money. We tried to stay away from optical composites as much as possible. One, because even as a mature art, which it was at that point, it still looked a little cheesy to me, and to do it super, super well was expensive. So we tried to stay away from opticals, but we have a number of them. But we tried to do as much in camera and with large scale miniatures and that sort of thing, and with small rear projections built into
pictures.
All the tricks that we didn't pioneer them, but we adapted them to low budget filmmaking at the Corman shop over. Really, three films. It was Battle Beyond the Stars, where we first started working together. Then it was Galaxy of Terror. It was also released as Planet of Horror and released as
Very different.
Mind Warp and Infinity of Terror. Same movie with three different titles. And then Escape from New York, which we did as an outside contract job for John Carpenter. Across those three films, we developed a pretty good little palette of techniques that were relatively straightforward and inexpensive and required a lot of craftsmanship. I think there's less kind of hands-on craftsmanship in visual effects these days because so much can just be fixed downstream digitally. Almost anything could be corrected or hidden or added to or enhanced with CG now. So there's much less emphasis on what's going in front of an actual camera lens.
Right, right. And so to that point, and especially where you've sort of gone in terms of digital technology, have you felt that in Hollywood there's a bit of the pendulum is sort of swinging back now, and have you felt the need to go back to more practical in-camera effects to a certain degree? Or does that, you know, I don't want to stray from Aliens, but, you know, what you're doing...
Yeah, yeah. No, I understand. I mean, there's a very far cry between the techniques that were used on The Terminator and Aliens and the technique used on Avatar, for example. I mean, you couldn't be at more opposite ends of the spectrum. But the point is that when we made Avatar... I mean, when we made Aliens, those techniques didn't exist. If I could do the Alien Queen today with the techniques we used on Avatar, she'd be spectacular. She'd be much more dynamic. Now, where I would struggle is to make her as texturally real, but that's all doable now. I'm not interested in my personal technique in swinging the pendulum back, maybe a little bit, maybe a tiny bit, in the sense that I think to do really, really high-quality CG creatures and settings, you have to hang your hat on something. You have to have some photographic source as a reference. And the more you can have, the more reference you have, the better the CG will be, because it gives you a bar that you have to hit. Mm-hmm. So, for example, on the new Avatar films, I'm actually going to shoot more real-world stuff. It may only be there as an example from which we then generate CG, or we may actually integrate some of those photographic elements.
Mm-hmm.
But I want more photography so that I get the exact way. Like if I was doing the Alien Queen, I would want photography to show the exact way that the slime drooled off the curl of a lip and caught the light in a certain type of very low-key lighting. You know,
mm-hmm.
I'd want to see that. And then so I could talk to the CG artist and say, all right, do that.
Sure.
Because otherwise the lighting, it's all about the lighting. It's generally not the creation of the models, and it's generally not the what they call the sims, the kind of dynamic effects of water and wind and mist and fire and all that stuff. They've got all that down. It always usually boils down to the lighting and the conception of the shot. And I find that we're, as a community, effects are straying more away from a base in photography. Like the people generating effects now never did a damn bit of photography in their lives. They're trying
right.
to create it all mathematically based on some hypothesis that's in their mind. You know,
mm-hmm.
but I come from having shot stuff. And so I'll always know when we've strayed too far, but the quickest reality check you can do is to actually shoot something. And so that's why I'm going to try to loop it back, just as a kind of a reality check. But in terms of honoring all those old techniques, things like hanging miniatures and front projection, rear projection, glass matte paintings and things like that, I wouldn't go back to all that stuff.
You wouldn't Nothing go back that to that?
No,
just because of the complications of getting that just right, I would think.
Too limiting. It's too limiting. There's so many ways in which you can't move the camera, so many ways in which your scale is limited, your depth of field is limited, things like that. I just think you can get better results now. I mean, I think digital used properly and CG used properly creates a superior product, but it's not always used properly, and it's usually used improperly when it gets uncoupled from an underlying sense of cinematography.
Well, I'd love to talk a little bit about casting and working with the actors for Aliens. You're wonderfully inheriting Sigourney Weaver, who loves your script and has agreed to do another round as Ripley. What did she bring to the table that was new or different that you enhanced the script with based on her input?
Well, Sigourney is very collaborative, and I was kind of in awe of her. I was in awe of her as an actor, and I was in awe of the character of Ripley. And, you know, I think she sensed my awe as hesitation, and she was very quick to kind of take control, and then at a certain point I had to say, accept, no, we're doing it my way. And I think that at that point, and I'm talking about 2 or 3 days in, at that point it didn't lead to like big fights. What it led to was a healthy creative relationship, and she and I have stayed friends, you know, since then. I think, you know, she would question everything in a good way, like, you know, what do I feel about Newt right now? And but it was never contentious. I always recall it being, I don't want to say effortless, because she's very in her head and so am I. So as kind of we both tend to go to an intellectual place more than a visceral place. And and sometimes it would be my job to pull us back to a more visceral or emotional place, interestingly enough, because usually the actor will take you there first. But I think it made it a stronger picture, and my collaborations since with her, my biggest one obviously being Avatar, was very much the same pattern. And we both, you know, kind of take strength from each other that way.
About the other characters, when I look at everyone who is just sort of a perfect fit for this film, I think Paul Reiser is the most curious choice. I mean, he's
really
great.
Interesting. I mean, I think we think of Paul Reiser a little bit too much from all the stuff he did after Aliens, because
right.
Paul really settled into his niche as the kind of glib, fast-talking, funny, smart guy, but he always played in comedies, whether it was straight comedy or romantic comedy or whatever it was. We think of him as a comedic actor. And he certainly was that before Aliens, but he hadn't settled into a niche enough for me to think of it as baggage that hurt the movie. And it certainly didn't hurt the movie when it first came out, because people didn't know that much who he was.
Exactly.
You know, he was just a new up-and-coming guy, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's probably one of the few times that he actually really deviated from what he settled into later. So now you look back on it, and it seems a little odd. At the time, it wasn't. You know?
Oh, when I saw it first run in the theater, he was a new face to me. But I always found him to be kind of a very interesting choice because, and I'm sure this is obviously very intentional, he kind of is a sort of this baby-faced exec who seems completely out of place, and then he becomes such a duplicitous character, and it is such a surprise.
Yeah, I was playing with our tendency to read people and our tendency to cast to type in movies. So Bishop, who turns out to be a really good-hearted, almost saintly character, self-sacrificing and very supportive. Our expectation is he's going to be, you know, kind of the lemon. He's going to be the guy that turns. He's the guy to watch because he had that saturnine kind of face. Lance Henriksen, the actor, it's like, you know, and whereas Paul Reiser, you kind of trust him, you know. And he was kind of baby-faced, and he did seem to be very supportive of her. And, of course, he turns out to be the guy that's completely, you know, psychopathic. So it's really just about playing against your expectations as an audience.
When with Carrie Henn, and after you cast her, I would think a very important element of working with a child actor is keeping their sense of imagination and involvement very alive during a very long days where you're sitting around and waiting. I'm very curious.
The atmosphere you created,
and also if there was concern about, you know, she's surrounded by these monsters, you know,
Psychological
welfare.
I wanted to engage Carrie's imagination, but I didn't want to engage it too much, because I didn't want her having nightmares, you know. So there was a certain insulation that was done. I didn't focus much on the creatures with her at all. I didn't like, you know, I think at one point I took her to the creature shop so that she could see that the monsters were all made out of rubber and it was all just made up, dress up, you know, and that helps, I think. I didn't want her to really project herself as a 9-year-old girl into
right.
being on an alien planet threatened by monsters with your family wiped out. So what I focused her on was the other actors, and encouraged her to make relationships with the other actors, and she really bonded with Sigourney, which was good, and Sigourney helped her a lot. The thing about Carrie is she wasn't an actress. She had zero training. She was completely raw talent. She had never been on a set before, and I think her parents didn't really get a sense that was something that they wanted her to do. And whether it was them or whether it was her, she never went on into an acting career. So it's a completely unique experience for her. I met her again recently, a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. Hadn't seen her in the interim, and you know, she I think she's in a place now where she treasures the memory of having done it, and maybe there's even a wistfulness, like, wow, I could have gone on and done that, but I didn't. But I don't think there's any big sense of regret, you know, around having done it, or regret around having not continued with it.
How do you feel Aliens has held up 30 years later? I mean, are you critical of your work in general when you look back at it? Do you always sort of nitpick, I could have done that scene better, I would have done this differently? Or do you like to keep it as in a time capsule?
Well, I think it's both. But look, I cringe a little bit when I watch Terminator at some of the stuff that was really threadbare. I think Aliens, we fought it to a draw based on the technology available at the time, and I'm pretty proud of the film. I don't cringe at anything in Aliens, and I don't think I could have done it better with the actors or with the writing. I think all that stuff was right on the money. It's a good story. It's told well. I think we made the right decisions in post-production, we took out about 20 minutes of stuff. And it just really improved the movie, just the pace and the momentum of the film. And I think we made pretty much the right creative decisions. And every film is a cross-section or a snapshot of the technology available at the moment that it was made. And so it's pointless to say, well, today I would have done it with this, I would have done this with CG, I would have done that differently, and the nuclear explosion would have been a really gorgeous simulation, and it would have looked a lot more real. You have to edit all that stuff out and say, okay, this film was made 30 years ago. I think that it still holds up pretty damn well. I don't think that the average unsophisticated, you know, technically unsophisticated viewer would, I don't think, feel a big deficit in that film. And I think actually kind of the opposite. I mean, in a funny way, stylistically, it's a bit a product of the limitations of the time. There's more emphasis on character. There's more emphasis on dark, creepy photography. And I might have today tended to kind of open it up and make it more dynamic and more of an action movie because I could. I could run those aliens around all over the place, jumping, climbing walls and doing all sorts of things in CG. It might have lost some of its creepy kind of chiaroscuro quality. So, you know, I think it stands. It stands, and I think it's still remarkably effective. And I the feedback I get, and you can answer this better, you're more connected to the fan base, is that it's still considered kind of a milestone. So I'm proud of that. You know, would I want to make another Alien movie tomorrow? No, I don't think so, unless somebody could come up with some, like, you know, spectacularly new concept.
So you wouldn't rule out returning to that world if the idea was compelling enough?
Well, look, I've got my own kind of alien world that I'm you know, enslaved to now with the Avatar films, so I can pretty much rule that out.
Aliens earned 7 Oscar nominations at the Academy Awards, including Best Actress for Sigourney Weaver, and it won for Best Visual Effects and Best Sound Effects Editing. It made $180 million worldwide at the box office. Of course, the franchise has continued for better or worse between the sequels, Alien vs. Predator films, and Ridley Scott's own return with the arguably polarizing Prometheus. Pick up the new issue of Famous Monsters today for more of my exclusive interview with James Cameron, including his fond memories of FM, which he used to hide under his textbooks at school, and also his Avatar sequels update. And look for the amazing Aliens cover with the stunning original art of Ripley and the Alien Queen by the talented Brian Taylor. The jam-packed issue also contains a tribute to the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, featuring interviews with Nichelle Nichols, Rod Roddenberry, and John Cho with his preview of Star Trek Beyond, plus interviews with the cast of The Conjuring 2 and Ghostbusters director Paul Feig. There's retrospect pieces with Richard Donner on The Omen, Michael York and Jenny Agutter on Logan's Run, Patrick Duffy on The Man from Atlantis, and so much more. You can find the magazine on newsstands, specialty shops, and Barnes & Noble, and you can order it online at CaptainCo.com, along with cool Famous Monsters apparel and merchandise. And you can also get the issue digitally at Magzter.com. That's M-A-G-Z-T-E-R. And there's just a few days left on our Kickstarter project in celebration of Forrest J. Ackerman's centennial. FM's founding father would have been 100 this November, and we're doing a comic book anthology called Tales from the Acker Mansion, featuring a variety of original stories from incredible talent that includes John Carpenter, William Nolan, Richard Christian Matheson, and so many more. You can get full details for that at famousmonsters.com or our imprint AmericanGothicPress.com and, of course, Kickstarter.com. Tales from the Acker Mansion will make its appearance on Halloween weekend at FM's first Alien Con, a major convention that we're doing in partnership with History and A&E. It's the first convention devoted to exploring space and the unknown, with plenty of pop culture guests joining the stars of ancient aliens, including familiar faces from Farscape, Battlestar Galactica, Lost in Space, Land of the Lost, and both Alien and Aliens, including Newt herself, Carrie Henn. Thank you very much for listening to the Famous Monsters podcast. You can find Famous Monsters on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, YouTube, pretty much all the social media channels, and standing on your street corner handing out flyers. If you enjoyed this podcast and enjoy Famous Monsters magazine and our comics at American Gothic Press, please spread the word and make sure to incorporate horror, sci-fi, fantasy, and genre pop culture into your conversations to ensure generations of monster kids to come. So, until next time, stay frosty.
Get away from her, you bitch!
The Famous Monsters podcast is copyright Famous Monsters and Movieland Classics, LLC, all rights reserved. The podcast is produced by Captured Aural Fantasy Theater. Find out more at CapturedAuralFantasy.com. That's Aural with an A-U and Fantasy with a P-H. Aliens music and clip courtesy 20th Century Fox.